Having today is lecture five. We're continuing on the categorical syllogism. I'm back here in Los Angeles. Last week I was at the Austrian Scholars Conference at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. It was a very nice conference. I'm glad to get through it. I had to give my lecture, New Church lecture on Judaism and Catholicism. I was telling them because of the subject, maybe we should call it the Lou Synagogue lecture this time. So I got some laughs out of that. I was glad of that. Now today what we're going to be doing is continuing the topic last week. Now remember, last week we got to the real main part of the course, which is we're trying to figure out how in deductive logic we arrive at two truths, new truths, not two truths, new truths. I'm a little out of it today, I guess. So we're trying to arrive at new truths, and how do we do that? Well, remember, we'll just review a little bit. In a syllogism, which is a deductive argument, there are three propositions, three judgments. We have two premises and the conclusion. So what we have in the conclusion, remember, every proposition is joining two terms by the copula, which is the verb is. So let's say all men are mortal. It joins men and mortal. Then we have Socrates and man. We have, again, a copula. Socrates and man are joined. And we have the conclusion, Socrates is mortal. Therefore, in the conclusion, again, we're joining two terms. So the most important thing to remember about a syllogism is to take the conclusion. We have this Socrates is mortal. So we have the subject of the conclusion and the predicate of the conclusion. Whenever, for any judgment or proposition, we'll have a subject and predicate. So what we do in a syllogism, we take the predicate of the conclusion and join it to another term. And when we do that, that's the major premise. Then we take the subject of the conclusion and join it to that same other term. That's the minor premise. So in this case, I said all men are mortal. Socrates is man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal is the one we're considering. So what is the middle term? Well, it's the one that doesn't appear in the conclusion. So we take the predicate of the conclusion is mortal, and then that joined to the middle term, men, in the major premise. So we have all men are mortal. Then we take the subject of the conclusion, which is Socrates, we join that to the middle term, and that's called the minor premise. So we have Socrates is the man. And then what we have in the conclusion, the middle term drops out, and we get the conclusion. So the basic. So we have each term in the conclusion is linked to the same middle term. So that's how we can link them together in the conclusion. And again, just some other review because we'll be needing this for the lecture today. Remember, there's the four different types of propositions. We have universal affirmative, like all giraffes are tall. Then we have particular affirmative, some giraffes are tall. We have universal negative, no giraffes are tall. We have particular negative, some giraffes are not tall. So we have a universal affirmative, it's an A proposition. Particular affirmative is an I proposition. That universal negative is an E and then particularly negative, it's an O, sounds like kind of a something like E-I-E-I-O, sounds like something from one of those child's ballads, but it isn't, it's scholastic logic. So we have these different types of universal propositions. Then we also have to remember, and I didn't go into the details of this back then, we have what's called the figure of the syllogism. What does that mean? Well, remember, the major premise has the predicate of the conclusion combined with the middle term, but we have to ask which in the major premise, what's the subject and predicate? And similarly, in the minor premise, which is the subject term, subject and conclusion combined with the middle term, what is the subject and predicate of the minor premise? Is it the middle term that's the subject, or is it either the predicate or subject and conclusion? So we have there are different figures depending on how we answer that question. And so that's what's meant by the figure. Then we have the mood of the syllogism, which again doesn't mean how syllogism is feeling, but that means what is the combination of A, E, I, and O propositions that constitutes a particular syllogism. Like, say, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That all those propositions are A propositions. We have all men are mortal is an A. It's a universal affirmative. Socrates is a man is also a universal because it's saying taken as a universal, even though it's only talking about one Socrates, it's sort of all the Socrates that there is a man. And the conclusion in this case, A, is also a universal affirmative that Socrates is mortal. All the Socrates that there is mortal. So then we have A, A, A. So that would be the mood of the syllogism. And then we could also get what the figure is. In this case, we have all men are mortal is the major premise. And here, the middle term is the subject of the major premise. And then in Socrates is a man, which is the minor premise, man is the predicate of the minor premise. So if you have that, that's called a syllogism, that's a syllogism in the first figure. If you have the major premise has the middle term in the subject position, and the middle term in the predicate position in the minor premise. Now, I'm sure this is all very confusing, but if you go over it a few times, it'll be less confusing. Of course, I've been over it a lot of times, and I still find it confusing, but I'm sure you'll do better than I do. So, because you're younger, so you'll do better. If that isn't logical, I don't know what is. So, that's what we're doing for, that was just review that we'll need for the rest of this lecture. Okay, now what we want to do now is what we could ask, well, we've explained what a syllogism is, but what is the principle behind the syllogism? What principle makes it the case that this syllogistic reasoning is true? And the scholastics appeal to a principle which he called the dictum de omni et nullo. The dictum is kind of a principle or a law or a saying, and omni means everything and nullo is nothing. It's the law of all and none. And what this is saying is something very straightforward is we'll take the dictum de omni first, whatever is affirmed universally of any subject is therefore affirmed of every logical part of that subject. That's very straightforward. You say, suppose you say all men are mortal. So then that applies to any particular man within the group. It's saying if you say that something is true for an entire class, then it's true for every part of that class. And this is something that's considered, according to Scholastic, the basic principle of reasoning. Now, let's say the dictum de nullo, it's still straightforward, a little bit more complicated. Let's say we exclude something from a class. We say, no men are immortals. Let's say no animals are immortal. So what we're saying there is the class of animals is totally excluded from the class of immortal beings. So saying no animal is in that class. You can imagine, again, I'm too inept to draw this, we could just imagine two circles that are not overlapping at all. The circle with the animals in it is not overlapping the circle with the immortals. So then suppose you say all men are animals. So that's to say that the circle, the class of men is included within the class of animals. So it follows by dictum de nullo that no man is immortal, just because we've said men are included in the class of animals, and animals are totally excluded from the class of immortals, so then men are excluded from the class of immortals. So these dictum de omni et nullo enables you, it gives the basis for both positive and syllogisms, one that have all affirmative propositions, and also syllogisms that have a negative premise. And does anyone remember how many negative premises can you have in a syllogism? Does anybody remember that? I hope I do. How many negative premises can you have in a syllogism? Remember, there are two premises in the syllogism. How many of them can be in one? One, yes, that's right. People know you can't have two negative premises in the syllogism. You can only have one. You can have either two positive premises or one positive and one negative, but not two negative. So the Scholastics thought this dictum de omni et nullo was the basic principle of reasoning. And now I give, here's another example that I gave. I'm giving one, maybe this I'm trying to make some jokes. They're usually bad ones, but here I give you an example. All men are elephants. Socrates is an elephant, and so therefore, I'm Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is an elephant. So here, what's affirmed universally of men, that all men are elephants, is affirmed a part of the class of men, that is Socrates. So see how it's pretty straightforward here. Now, what we've said so far is, well, how do we know that the syllogism is true? And then we've appealed to the dictum de omni et nullo. But then we can push the question back another step. How do we know that dictum is true? We said, well, it's true because syllogism is, reasoning is, it follows because of this dictum de omni et nullo. But how do we know that's true? In the Scholastic view, we directly grasp its truth. It's just like supposing someone that why is 2 plus 2 equals 4? Well, just we immediately grasp, as soon as we know what 2 plus 2 equals 2 plus 2 and 4 mean, we immediately grasp it's true. So, in a similar way, if you think about this, say, the dictum de omni, that if a class is included in another class, then fixate what's true. A part of the first class will then be included in the wider class. But if something applies, if something can be predicated with a whole class, it could be predicated with parts of the class. That seems quite evident. But suppose you deny it, then you get a violation of the law of contradiction. Remember in one of the previous lectures, we got into problems that happen if you deny the law of contradiction. You're going to be facing contradiction, explosion, and all sorts of other nasty things. So what happens, say, if you deny the dictum de omni, then you'd be affirming both an A proposition and an O proposition, which would be contradictory at the same time. Suppose you say all men are elephants, and then suppose you deny the dictum de omni, you say it's not true, even though all men are elephants, it's not true of each man that he's an elephant. So you'd be saying some man is not an elephant, and all men are elephants, but those are contradictories. So if you deny the dictum de omni, you're affirming both sides of a contradiction. You wouldn't want to do that, or at least I hope not. Now, an important point about the dictum de omni, remember the dictum says, if something is true of a universal subject, a class, then it's true of all the parts of the class. So what we're doing in the dictum, we're taking it, affirming some property of a class. We're not taking it as a collection of individuals. Let's take the example that all men are mortal. What we're doing there is saying that the property of being mortal attaches to man. It's an attribute of man that he's mortal. It isn't that we have imagined that all the men that ever will exist are surveyed and we find out that each one is mortal. It isn't that we're just collecting all the individuals and then saying, well, we have a proposition that's true of all these individuals, so then therefore it applies to one of the individuals within the class. We're not just enumerating them. It isn't, say, what would be an example of enumeration? Suppose everybody taking this class is under 40 years old. I don't know if that's true, but I mean, suppose it is. I could say this person's under 40, this person's under 40, this person's under 40. That would be an enumeration, but that isn't what we're talking about in the dictum de omni. No, what we're doing here is talking about a property of a class. We're taking the class as a whole and then saying, what's true of the whole class applies to each of the parts. So here's another example. And why do we do it that way? Why did I make such a point that we don't want to do things by enumeration? We don't want to take victim by enumeration. Am I just making a fuss over very little? You must answer no if you want to pass the course. That was just a joke, incident. Okay. So let's take, here's an example. Suppose we say all students interested in this course are interested in logic. Then we have a second premise, Andreas is a student in this course. Therefore, Andreas is interested in logic. Well, would this be a good example of syllogistic reasoning? It seems like it follows, doesn't it? It isn't committed. Committing any fallacy. Now I see there's a question from Joanna, do we consider the basis for making premises? Yes, that's an excellent question. We're going to be getting to that, how we know the premises. That'll be coming up, especially in the last lecture. But this is it's a very good question, but we'll be getting to that later. Okay, so let's look at this one. all students in this course are interested in logic. Andreas is a student in this course, therefore Andreas is interested in logic. Well, it doesn't seem like it's committing any of the fallacies we talked about before. It's, you know, there's no undistributed middle. It seems like doesn't the conclusion follow from the premises? So maybe is this all right? So what's wrong though is how could we find out that the first premise is true? And here we're in part addressing the question Joanna raised and how we know the premise is true. Well, how would you find out that all the students in this course are interested in logic? Well, you could only find that out by checking whether each student is interested in logic. I mean, there's no general principle that says you have to be interested in logic to enroll, to be a student in this course. I mean, you could easily come up with counterexamples. I mean, suppose someone, you weren't interested in logic, but somebody offered you a lot of money to enroll in the course. I mean, we couldn't exclude such a possibility just by thinking about it. So the only way we could find out that all students in this course are interested in logic is consider each one, say, are you interested in logic? Are you interested in logic? Then if turns out everyone is, then the first premise would be true. But what happens if we do that? Well, since Andreas is in the course, then we would already know that Andreas is interested in logic. So this syllogism would have no point to it because we would already be given in the premise that he's interested in logic. So what's the point of deducing it? It would be a useless exercise. It wouldn't result in anything new. Remember, what we're trying to do in a syllogism is come up with new reason. We're not just repeating what we said in the premise. And Joyce, in our textbook, wouldn't count this as reasoning at all. Now, another thing, and here we'll be getting into some of the fallacies. Remember, I'm trying to, in these lectures, I'm trying to not only explain some of the principles of logic, but give you examples of bad reasoning. Now, the dictum de omni, which says whatever applies to the logical whole applies to the logical part, it shouldn't be confused with the fallacy of division. And what's involved in the fallacy of division is that what applies to a conjunction is wrongly taken to apply to the parts of the conjunction. Sometimes it's hard to figure out or realize that you're committing the fallacy of division because it isn't always evident on its face that you've got a conjunction. Let's consider an example, which is a very important one to understand if you're interested in the history of economics. This is one that I cover in the other course I'm giving, the history of economic thought, and it's come up. Those of you studying Austrian economics are familiar with it, but what I want to do here is analyze the diamond water paradox. Have anyone heard of the diamond water paradox? You might have heard of this from your study of economics. I want to show the logical structure of this so-called paradox, how it commits the fallacy of division. Now, before the marginalist revolution, which took place in the 1870s, most economists thought that subjective values couldn't explain prices. Suppose, say, why does an automobile, say, cost more than a newspaper? So one way of trying to explain that would be, so, well, people value automobiles more than they do newspapers. They would appeal to the different subjective values that consumers have for various products to explain the price. But most economists thought before the 1870s that wasn't the right way to try to figure out what explains prices. They gave this argument. They said, well, water is more valuable than diamonds. I mean, after all, we couldn't live without water, but we could very easily live without diamonds. Water is essential for life, so isn't water more valuable than diamonds? So if subjective value explains prices, then water should have a higher price than diamonds. Because remember, the idea we're trying to examine is if people value a good more, then its price will be higher. But people value water more than diamonds, so then water should have a higher price than diamonds. But that isn't the case in reality. Diamonds have a higher price than water. So this is the what we've done here. We've derived by a valid argument that water has a higher price than diamonds. So we have certain premises. We say water is more valuable than diamonds, and we say the price of the good depends on how highly consumers value it. So we derive the conclusion water has a higher price than diamonds. Doesn't it depend on the offer demand? Well, I'm not sure what you mean by offer demand, but what we're not trying to figure out here what actually does cause prices. We're just interested in the structure of this particular argument here. This isn't an economics class, unless I made a mistake and I should be giving my economics lecture. I think that's Wednesday. So what we're doing here is we're just, remember, different distinctions between validity and truth. We're just considering what follows from these particular premises. So I say we derive by a valid argument that water has a higher price than diamonds. But this conclusion is false because, in fact, diamonds have a higher price than water. So what happens? We have a valid argument. We have a false conclusion. Then one of the premises has to be wrong. Because remember, if the premises were true and we derive something validly from them, then the conclusion is true. The conclusion is false. So it must be one of the premises, at least one of the premises is false. So this is similar to a reductio ad absurdum argument. It's not exactly the same because we derive the conclusion from our premises, water has a higher price than diamonds. Now that's false, but it's not a contradiction. I mean, imagine a world in which water did have a higher price than diamonds. There wouldn't be anything contradictory about it. In the reductio ad absurdum, we derive a logical contradiction. But what we're doing here is analogous to reductio ad absurdum. We're saying we derive the false conclusion from our premises, we have a valid argument to a false conclusion, therefore there must be something wrong with at least one of the premises. So what explains what went wrong? Well, this paradox has committed the fallacy of division. So when we take the premise water is more valuable than diamonds, that's true only for the total quantities of water and diamonds in the world. We imagine sort of all the water in the world that there is being collected, and then we have on the other hand, other side, all the diamonds there are. So we would say which is more valuable, which would people rate more highly. We have to consider all the water in the world or all the diamonds in the world. Well, probably consumers would value all the water in the world higher than all the diamonds because they wouldn't be able to live without any water at all. So what we have to realize is even though, say, water is more valuable than diamonds, it doesn't explicitly have a conjunction in it. It doesn't say the water over here plus the water over there plus the water over there is more valuable than diamonds here, diamonds here, diamonds there. But it's in, there's an implicit conjunction in this premise. So what that's what you have to realize, that we have an implicit conjunction. And then if you take account of that, it doesn't follow from saying that all, if you take, add up all the water and say that's more valuable than add it than what you'll get if you add up all the time, it doesn't follow that any particular quantity of water will be more valuable than any particular quantity of diamonds. In the economics course, you would be going into the marginal principle and see exactly why not. But here we're just interested in the logical structure. So we're interested in the principle of the fallacy of division. Here we're taking a collection in the sense of just adding up things. So it doesn't follow, if something is true of the things taken when you've added them all up, it doesn't follow that it applies to each particular thing that we've added up. So see, that's different from this dictum de omni, because that says, if the omni says, this isn't a fallacy, says, if something is true of a whole logical class, it applies to each part of the class. So that's different from fallacy of division, because remember we're saying something applies to is a property of a certain class, like all men in the world would say men necessarily have the property of being mortal, or have the property of being mortal, so then each particular one has. But it isn't fallacy of division, because fallacy of division would be something like saying, the example of fallacy of division involving men, you say, well, men live in Europe, Africa, and North and South America, so you couldn't conclude from this, there's a particular man who lives at the same time in Europe, Africa, and North and South America. That would be fallacy of division. So see, make sure you grasp the difference there. Now, so we have fallacy of division is, you say, what applies to a conjunction is wrongly said to apply to part of the conjunction. So we have kind of the reverse fallacy, which is what applies to part of a conjunction is wrongly applied to the whole conjunction. And I'm going to give a famous example from the history of philosophy that appears to commit this fallacy, and this is John Stuart Mill's proof of the principle of utility. And remember, Mill was a utilitarian. He thought that what we should all be aiming at is the general happiness, or what was best for everyone. And he said, no reason can be given why the general happiness is desirable, except that each person desires his own happiness. So what he's trying to do is show, well, each of us desires his or her own happiness. So then he said, well, from that you can get a proof of the general happiness is desirable. So he says, this, however, being a fact, namely each person desires his own happiness, we have not only all the proof which the case admits of, but all which is possible to require that happiness is a good. That each person's happiness is a good to that person, and the general happiness, therefore, a good to the aggregate of all persons. Mill didn't believe in very short sentences. Someone's put in a comment here. Keith wants to know that Rockway has a throwaway line remark about J.S. Mill not being much philosopher. Could that be one of the reasons Rockport thought that? Well, it might very well be. I think he had a Rothbard had a poor opinion of utilitarianism, although I don't think he mentions this failing that I'm going to be going into explicitly, but could have been. Okay, so what's the fallacy? Is when he says, in the general, happiness therefore is a good in the aggregate of all persons. Let's look at what he says. Remember, he says each person desires his own happiness, so then the general happiness is a good to all persons. So it doesn't follow, because what he's saying is, let's imagine different persons, so said A's happiness is good to A, B's happiness is good to B, C's happiness is good to C. So what he's saying is everyone will have to take the sum of happiness, A plus B plus C, as something desirable. So this wouldn't follow, because you don't have to hold, you're not logically required to hold, there's a good to the aggregate of all persons. Somebody could just say, well, all there is goods to each particular person. But you wouldn't have to say, supposing I'm aiming for my happiness, and say, Keith and Joanna are each aiming for their respective happinesses. You wouldn't have to hold there's some kind of envy, my happiness plus Keith's happiness plus Joanna's happiness that we're all aiming for. That would be, that's the fallacy of composition. Now, while we're picking on John Stuart Mill, I want to illustrate another, in the same paragraph, he commits another fallacy. So, if we're going to beat up on someone, why not John Stuart Mill? Rothbard certainly wouldn't be happy about attacking him. So let's see, the same paragraph said, the only proof capable of being given that an object is visible, you can see it, is that people actually see it. The only proof that a sound is audible is that people hear it. In like manner, I apprehend, the sole evidence that it's possible to prove that anything is desirable is that people do actually desire it. So he's saying, well, how do we know that, let's say, something is, if we want to know something visible, he says, well, we just see, do people see it, so then it has the property, we know it has the property of being capable of being seen just from the fact that people see it. So he said, well, how do we know something is desirable? Well, if people actually do desire it, doesn't that show that it has this capacity of being something capable of being desired? Now, if he said that, it would be perfectly all right. That would be perfectly all right, but the problem is Mill commits a fallacy of equivocation, because he uses the analogy to argue that if something is desired, then it ought to be desired. Suppose I say it's desirable that everyone's rights be respected. What would we mean then? It would be something like everyone ought to have his or her rights respected. In ethics, when we talk about something being desirable, it's another way of saying that we ought to favor or do whatever we're talking about. But desirable also means something that people actually do want. If I desire an ice cream cone, I could say ice cream is desirable simply because it has the property of being something that attracts me. But see, there's a distinction between something that people want and what they ought to want. So Mill here, since he's talking about the ethical use of desire, he's equivocating, so he committed a fallacy of equivocation. Now, I should say, in defense of Mill, that, like I said, while he's committed these two fallacies, he's committed fallacy of composition, fallacy of equivocation in the same paragraph, two fallacies in one paragraph are not too bad, but there are philosophers who come up with defenses of Mill. They say, no, you can take his argument in different ways, and this has generated enormous literature. although I think there's a good case to be made that he does commit these fallacies. That's kind of a straightforward way to take the paragraph. But I'm not interested in this course so much in correctly interpret Mill, but I just wanted to give that so we could see these two important fallacies in action, fallacy of composition, fallacy of equivocation. Now, I'll just give another example to illustrate the fallacy of composition. And this is an illustration of fallacy of composition. It doesn't itself commit the fallacy. And this is the so-called paradox of thrift that the Keynesians use, Keynesian economists use. And they say, suppose a single person tried to say, suppose I say, well, I'd like to save up some money, so I'm going to take some of the money I get, I won't spend it all, I'll put it in the bank. So if a single person tries to save, his savings will increase. So the Keynesians say, well, it doesn't follow from that that if everyone tries to save at the same time, total savings will go up. And again, we don't need to get into the economic arguments they use for that. We're just interested in the logical point. But we can see it doesn't follow. They're right, it doesn't follow, because it could be the case that, say, I can only succeed in saving if somebody else doesn't save. I mean, it doesn't follow that everybody's act of saving is completely independent of everybody else's, decision to save. So it could be that the success of some people's decisions to save depends on the failure of others' attempts to save. So Keynes used this argument as to criticize people who said that we should encourage saving, at least in certain conditions. In fact, the argument goes back to the 18th century for Bernard de Mandeville. But here, again, we're not getting into problems with Keynesian economics, but notice, although it's right that if you were to argue if a single person tries to save, the savings will increase, if you argue, well, then, if everybody tries to save, everybody's savings will go up, that is an example of the fallacy of composition, if you argue that way, so far Keynes is right. But it doesn't follow that the conclusion is false. I mean, it could be that, in fact, everyone's attempt to save will succeed. So just to say that there's a fallacy of composition, if you say that one person tries to save, it doesn't follow. If everybody tries to save, it will be successful. If one person tries to save, it will be successful. It doesn't follow. If everybody tries to save, everybody will be successful. That's perfectly true, but you can't conclude from that in fact, if everybody tries to save, not everybody will succeed. That doesn't follow either. You see the distinction between saying something doesn't follow from a particular premise and saying that something doesn't follow at all. Now, getting back, we've gotten into these fallacies, fallacy of division, then fallacy of composition, fallacy of equivocation. Now, we want to go back to our old friend, the dictum, the omni. Now, remember when I gave you the review at the beginning, I said that the first figure shows the dictum most clearly. Now, can anybody tell me, does anybody remember, what is the first figure? Well, I take that the question because I've written the answer right there on the slide. So it wouldn't be such a good, it's not such a good question to ask the class because you can, Angela pointed out that phone rings every lesson. It's not guaranteed, but I don't know, I guess. It is funny because you always wonder who is it who's calling. But I'll find out later. Well, it's possible they hate us. Maybe they just hate me. That's all they need. Most people do, after all. Okay, so the first figure the major premise, that's the one with, that has the predicate term of the conclusion, has the middle term as a subject, and also has the middle term as predicate and minor premise. So let's take an example. Here we have no Misesians or Keynesians, all faculty of the Mises Institute are Misesian, and then we conclude no faculty of the Mises Institute are Keynesian. So first one, is this what is the mood of this syllogism? Well, we get that, we say, what is the first one? No Misesians or Keynesians, that's a universal negative. It says the class of Misesian is excluded from the class of Keynesians, a universal negative. So the next one is all faculty of the Mises Institute are Misesians. So that's a universal affirmative. Remember, we have to have one, at least one affirmative proposition, any valid syllogism. And the conclusion, no faculty of the Mises Institute are Keynesian. So it's also a universal negative. So what is the middle term here? Well, what is the term that's not in the conclusions and Misesians? And so we take the major premise, which would be the one that has Keynesians in it, because that's the predicate term. So the major premise is no Misesians or Keynesians. Here, the middle term is in the subject position. And in the minor premise, we take the subject term is faculty of the Mises Institute, join that with the middle term here, in the minor premise, the middle term is the predicate. So that's an example of the first figure. And in scholastic view, the first figure shows this dictum in the most clearly, because we can see here's the dictum de nullo. We're saying Misesians are excluded from the class of Keynesians, then faculty and Mises Institute are included in the class of Misesians, so then the faculty and Mises Institute are also excluded from the class of Keynesians. And I think if you think about that, you'll see it's very straightforward. Now, I didn't go into the details of this, but there are other figures besides the first figure. In the, just to go through this quickly, in the second figure, the middle term is the predicate of both the major and minor premise. In the third figure, the middle term is the subject of the major and minor premise. In the fourth figure, which the scholastic logicians really didn't like all that much, is the reverse. It has the reverse arrangement of the first figure. In the fourth figure, the predicate term is the predicate of the major premise, and the middle term is the predicate of the major premise, and the middle term is the subject of a minor premise. So the other way around from the first figure. Now, remember, we know that the first figure, we have something in the first figure, then we can see the dictum de omnia nullo applies to it. But what the scholastic logicians show, well, if we have these other figures, it isn't so immediately clear how the dictum de omnia applies, and we want it to apply because that's the basic principle that shows the syllogism is valid. So what we can do is we can change around the propositions in these other figures and get the syllogism into the first figure. We're not going to do that in this class. I don't think there's any real need to it. But the process of doing that depends on what's called immediate inference. I see Danny's pointing out that Rothbard once called J.S. Mill L. Wimpole. Yes, he much preferred Mill's father, James Mill, because he said, well, James Mill had a lot of wrong ideas, at least he was very decisive in what he said. John Stuart Mill was keep having these very elaborate qualifications of everything, and he really had trouble making up his mind. So what we mean by immediate inference is different from the syllogism. Remember, in the syllogism, what we're doing is taking two propositions to show how we can get some new proposition. In immediate inference, we take a single proposition, we come up with another proposition that follows from it. And we'll give some examples of how that can be done. Now, the first one is called, first kind we're going to talk about is called conversion. And conversion does not mean either changing your religion or taking stolen goods and trying to sell them. But conversion has another meaning in logic. What we're doing conversion, remember every proposition, you have a subject and predicate term joined by the copula is. So what we do in conversion is exchange the subject and predicate. We shift the predicate to the subject and the subject to the predicate. So what we do is, well, we have we have the proposition all men are mortal, so men is the subject and mortal is the predicate. So we shift it around, we then get some mortals are men. So see that what used to be the predicate is now the subject, what used to be the subject is now the predicate. Now, there are two rules that we have to follow in conversion. One is that both propositions have to have the same quality. Quality doesn't mean good or bad, but whether the quality refers to whether proposition is affirmative or negative. So here, when I had all men are mortal, that's an affirmative proposition. So the proposition I converted it to also has to be affirmative. Then the other rule is if a term isn't distributed in the original proposition, it can't be distributed in the new proposition. So this explains why didn't I say all men are mortal, so that when I converted, why didn't I get all mortals are men? Well, in the first proposition, mortal is undistributed. We don't know how much of the class of mortals is covered by the proposition. You know, all men, that's a distributed term. We're talking about all men, not just some men. But we don't know how much of a class of mortals we're talking about here. So we couldn't say all mortals are men. All we could say is some mortals are men. Now, I give an example. I give an example here. Supposing we have an E proposition, like no Misesians or Keynesians, we want to convert that. Want to interchange the subject and predicate, so we would get no Keynesian. We can convert no Keynesians are Misesians. I don't know why I put two here. It should be R. So we have no Misesians are Keynesians, we could get no Keynesians are Misesians. So by an E proposition, remember, no Misesians are Keynesians, that's saying, imagine two circles saying the circle of Misesians totally excludes the circle of Keynesians. So if the two circles are distinct, it doesn't matter which you take as a subject and predicate, they're still distinct from each other. So you can, when you have an E proposition, that both terms are distributed, so you can convert it just by reversing the subject and predicate. You don't have to change any all to some or anything like that. Now, another kind of immediate inference we're going to go over is called obversion. And here what we do is we keep the same subject but change the predicate into its contradictory. So how do we do this? Well, we have to change the quality of the proposition, that's to say affirmative to negative or negative to affirmative. So we have suppose we have all men are mortal. So we want to have the obverse of that. So what we do is we take the proposition all men, we change it to a negative proposition, so we would have no men instead of all men, and we would change the predicate into its contradictory, so we have no men are not mortal. But see, what we do is we have, we keep the same subject, men, because I say men, all men are mortal, we want to attach the same subject, men, to the contradictory predicate, not mortal. So how do we do that? We say all men are mortal. We couldn't say all men are not mortal, which is a contradiction, because that would just be contradicting our original premise, all men are mortal, all men are not mortal. What we want to do with the obverse, we're not getting a contradiction. We want to get another proposition that follows if the first one is true. Of course, the contradictory wouldn't follow. But suppose what we do then, we just change the quality, we change that, say all men are not mortal, we say no men are not mortal. Now there are a lot of other types of need inference, but we won't go into them here, contrapositives and obverted contrapositives. Joyce gives a quite elaborate account of these, but I'm just giving a few examples, which I think is all we need here. Now, I want to, since we're picking on John Stuart Mill in this lecture, I want to give an argument he gave. He questioned the whole validity of the syllogism. He said, you know, syllogism really isn't a cheat. I shouldn't say questioned validity in the sense that he thought that the conclusion of the syllogism doesn't follow from the premises. But he thought, syllogisms really don't achieve anything. He said, the major premise of the syllogism begs the question. I mean, begs the question. It's assuming what it's supposed to be proving. So what he says is, we couldn't, suppose we take the famous example again, all men are mortal, Socrates a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. He says, we couldn't know all men are mortal unless we examined each person and found that he was mortal. But then we would already know Socrates is mortal. We wouldn't need the syllogism to prove it. So according to Mill, we can't learn anything new by using the syllogism. Now, if you remember earlier in the lecture, I said the syllogism, the argument from the syllogism isn't one that goes by enumeration. Remember I gave the example, all students in this class are interested in logic. Andreas is a student in this class, therefore Andreas is interested in logic. And I said that wouldn't be a good argument, because the only way I could know all students are interested in logic is by checking if each one was, and then I'd already know Andreas was. So what Mill is basically saying is that all syllogisms are arguing by enumeration. So he said, well, you don't know the major premise then unless you already know that the conclusion is true, because if you didn't know the conclusion is true, you'd be unable to assert the major premise in the first place. So we've already seen what's wrong with Mill's argument. He's just wrongly taking the syllogism to be an argument for enumeration. But in fact, what we're doing in a major premise is we're talking about the necessary feature of the concept in the middle term. We say all men are mortal. We're saying we would be talking about the necessary, I shouldn't have said the middle, the necessary concepts of both middle and subject and predicate. We're talking about all men are mortal. We're talking about a necessary property of men. Here would be the middle term. We're saying, what is the necessary property of the concept man? It's not that we're enumerating all the men that there are and saying, turns out each one is more. We're saying there's a necessary property of the concept. So why did Mill miss that? Or why didn't Now, Key says he's an early denier of induction. No, we'll be getting to that in the last lecture. Mill defended induction. He's criticizing the usefulness of deduction rather than induction. So Mill didn't think there were any such things as conceptual necessity. So he'd say, in reply to me, look, you're saying it's part of the concept of man that man is mortal, but there aren't such things as conceptual necessity. So if you say, well, what about examples like 2 plus 2 equals 4? Well, he said, those are just empirical generalizations, just we keep adding up collections of two quantities or something, two quantities of something else, and we count them up, we'll find they always come to 4. So it's a very well-established empirical generalization, but there's nothing, it isn't a conceptual necessity. So that's why we thought everything in the major premise of syllogism is just an enumeration. So to conclude a little bit on regressive and progressive syllogism, and these don't refer to whether something is politically moving forward to backward, but this refers to progressive syllogism is reasoning from cause to effect. For example, when you say rent control will produce a shortage of apartments, and then you say the city council has just imposed rent control, you conclude we will have a shortage of apartments. So see here, you're saying we have a certain cause, rent control is going to produce a shortage of apartments, and say, oh, here's an instance of a cause. The city council has just imposed rent control, so we conclude we'll have a shortage of apartments. The reasoning from cause to effect. And then we can go the other way. We can say in regressive syllogism, we're reasoning from effect to cause. For example, suppose we say a business cycle under certain conditions must result from an expansion of bank credit. So here we're not saying that, we're saying if we have a business cycle, then what's brought it about is an expansion of bank credit. So then we say, well, we're now in a business cycle in these conditions, so we conclude that this business cycle resulted from the expansion of bank credit. So this is the regressive syllogism, where we say, well, here's an effect, so then we can conclude that something has caused it. In the progressive one, we start with a cause, and then we conclude it'll have a certain effect. Now, I just want to give conclusion one more fallacy. I like to give you a lot of fallacies. I hope I don't give them inadvertently by making them in my lectures, but I just want to give you an example. Here's a quotation. It says, economist Danny Roderick is criticizing free market economy. That this dichotomy between markets and states, between trade and rules, is false and hides more than it reveals. So what he's criticizing is economists who say, well, we should rely on the free market, not have the government regulate the economy. People can work things out just by free voluntary interaction. We don't need to have a government telling us what to do. So he says market exchanges, especially long distance trade, cannot exist without rules imposed from somewhere. So he's saying, look, these people contrast trade and rules are wrong because we have to have rules imposed from somewhere. So he's saying, well, look, you think you can get along without the government, but you have to have the government imposing rules. So what's the fallacy here? Well, he says, like I said, the market exchange and especially long distance trade can exist without rules imposed from somewhere. Well, it doesn't follow from the necessity of rules that these rules have to be imposed, that we have to have a state. So what he's done here is he's forced us into a false choice. He hasn't considered all the possible alternatives. kind of a non-sequitur in the argument that, well, we have to have rules. That seems plausible. There have to be arrangements that people have of doing things. You can't just exist in a chaotic way where people couldn't know what was going to happen. But it doesn't follow from that. The rules have to be imposed or even more imposed by the state. Okay, so I think I finished now, or at least I know that, you know, I know I finished because that was the last slide, so that's a good sign I finished. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is go to the Q&A box and see if you've got any questions for me. I hope there'll be ones I'll be able to answer. This is always the case, but we'll see what we can do. I see Joanna can't hear anything. Well, I think since you commented in later in the lecture, I guess you were able to solve that problem. Now, Charles says, on the regressive cylinder, isn't there a hole in the argument? An expansion credit will cause the cycle, but it is not stated that only an expansion credit will cause the business cycle. What am I missing? Well, let's look at the So let's go back to the slide. The premise we started from was a business cycle in certain conditions must result from expansion of bank credit. And so then we said we're now in a business cycle in these conditions, and we conclude business cycles resulted from expansion of bank credit. Now, Charles, your criticism is that this major premise is false, but in fact all we know is that expansion of bank credit will cause a business cycle, but we don't know that only an expansion of bank credit will cause a business cycle. And I think you're perfectly right, but what I was concerned with here was just giving an example of an argument rather than whether the major premise is true. So I'm not claiming that the argument is true. Oh, there's the person calling it. I'm not claiming the argument is true. I'm just using that premise to show what a regressive syllogism, how we argue from an effect to a cause. So I think you're quite right. If this were a course in Austrian economics, you would have a good point. But here I'm just using this for the purposes of trying to show the example. Can you give an example? Well, this is a valid regressive syllogism. Now, if you want something like, I think what you might mean is one that has a true, where the premises are undoubtedly true. Well, let's take a case. What would be something like, we'd say this person, if someone has a bullet hole in him, he must have been shot. This person has a bullet hole in him, so we conclude this person must be shot. So we have a general statement that we start with. Here's an effect. This person, anyone who has a bullet hole in him must have been shot. And then this person has a bullet hole in him, so we got the particular effect, so then we conclude he must have been shot. Oh, good. Good. Now, I'm glad you guys don't shoot me. Yes. Well, again, Charles, you say in that, Charles says in that case, clearly the bullet only results from being shot. Again, remember the key distinction. I think that would be right, that you could see the premise is true. But remember, the key distinction between validity and truth, between whether the premise is in fact true, and validity is what follows from particular premises. But you're right, I was trying to give an example of a premise that is in fact true, since that was what Philip was asking. But Charles, you made a good point in your original question. You're quite right that someone could challenge that the business cycle has to result from the Spencer's bankrupt. But remember, I did specify under certain conditions. I mean, maybe you could so specify the conditions that a business, it would be true that a business cycle under those conditions has to result from expansion of bank credit. So I didn't say, you know, I didn't say any business cycle, but whether I could specify such conditions is, of course, another matter to make the premise really true. Okay, let's see also if anyone's put anything in the chat while we're waiting for more questions. We have two here. David says, sorry for an economic, not logical question. Austrian economics, is any valid function served by stock speculators? Are they considered to be capitalists or entrepreneurs? In other words, have people like Warren Buffett benefit society? Well, that does belong in the different kinds of patients, which they view as, you know, speculators help the market get to the market price more quickly because they it rock by putting out the aid equilibrium, but I really don't want to go into that because it's not really our topic. Joanna said, in absolute premises like there's no gold in Alaska, how could it be defended against all the possible challenges? Well, it might be, suppose you could, one example of how you might do that would be, suppose you could show that gold could only be found under certain circumstances, like say, you could turn out that in order to have gold in the ground, you need such and such conditions, and then you establish that Alaska doesn't have those conditions. That might be one way to show there's no gold in Alaska. Now, what you're perhaps referring to, this famous argument by Karl Popper, who was an important 20th century philosopher scientist, that a proposition like that, there's no gold in Alaska, could never be made false because you could just keep searching. You say, well, I haven't. What would be a way of saying that? Let me strike that last remark. There's no gold in Alaska. You could never show that that was really always universally true because you could say, well, I haven't found any gold so far, but how would that exclude that you would never find gold in the future? How would you know you could never discover gold later there? So he thought such a proposition could never be established. But as I say, that would depend on just taking it, kind of going over all the possible circumstances, saying, well, we can't exhaust them, so you could never establish that. Or if something helps, just, I mean, I'll ask you about people. Okay, let's see. Good, so we're going. I'll get off the stop mode. Okay, so let's see. We have still have about 15 minutes left. Does anyone have any other? We should have some more questions here. Now, Joanna said, couldn't the same chance come under the premise all men are mortal? Well, remember, Joanna, one thing I was trying to go over in the lecture is the distinction between taking a proposition as an enumeration, just like going through all the men and saying this one is mortal, this one is mortal, this one is mortal, and then say there's something about the concept of man that requires that all men are mortal. So if you took it the second way, you wouldn't be able to make that challenge because you say, well, it's just necessary it is. Maybe this is a good way to see this. Suppose you say 2 plus 2 equals 4. So you're thinking about it. Well, you see it has to be true, 2 plus 2 equals 4. So I don't think it would be a good objection to say, well, you know, we've always added up 2 and 2. We've always gotten 4. But how do we know? Maybe we could add up 2 and 2 and not get 4 sometime. How do we know, you know, there's an infinite number of times people could add up 2 and 2. So how do we know they'll always turn out to be 4? You see, that wouldn't be such a good objection because it just be 3. Just thinking about it, 2 plus 2 equals 4. So the analogous plane would be, well, when we think about what that's involved in the concept of man, we would see that man is mortal. So if we wouldn't get that right, then this premise wouldn't be subject to the challenge. Well, we've just gone through so and so many men, so those are mortal, but how do we know other men won't be? Well, I see Keith is still interested in the economics question. Well, I think it would be logical to try to keep the questions more on logic. You know, it would be funny if in my history of thought class people started asking me logical questions. Although, Keith, there's no reason. You don't have to apologize. You're welcome to discuss it. It's a very interesting question, probably much more relevant to what's going on now than what I'm saying. But it's just I have kind of a one-track mind. I can only concentrate on one subject at one time. You know, melody is hard enough for me. I can't handle a counterpoint too well. So I mean, you're welcome to continue that discussion in the chat. It's just wait now, let's see, here's something else. I guess Joanna says, I guess my thoughts were that while with a math we can prove Y2 plus 3, we can't prove that by the aforementioned premises. Right. Well, that's a very interesting question. Here what I would say is, suppose we consider 2 plus 2 equals 4. Well, you're perfectly right in math. We could derive that from various axioms of arithmetic. What I was claiming is we might be able just directly to grasp that it's true, 2 plus 2 equals 4, and it might be argued that we can grasp directly that all men are mortal, or we might be argued there are metaphysical arguments that show that. And I didn't say that such arguments are right, but what I was trying to do with a more limited claim is say, how could it be the case that we could assert a proposition like all men are mortal if we haven't gone through all the men that ever existed, shown that each one is mortal? So I was just sketching out a way one might do that, or actually two ways one might come up with metaphysical arguments that they are mortal, in which case we would be giving premises that we think are evident in deducing that men are mortal. Or we could claim it's directly evident just thinking about man that we see that man is mortal. Now, I'm not claiming, maybe you're very right to raise this point, that in fact either of those is true. But I'm just giving that as how one could get around this point that you're making. Well, how could I know that without just going through all the men that there are? And the answer is, you could do that by appealing to conceptual necessity. And you see, whether such an appeal is correct in a given case is another matter. But that's how you would do it. That would be the way you would do it. And I gather from your question, maybe I'm reading into what you're saying, you're rather suspicious of these conceptual necessities. But that would be a very important issue in philosophy. There are certainly people who agree with you, but if you accept syllogistic reasoning, you would be appealing to such necessity. Otherwise, the whole thing won't be able to get going with it. You'll get into the kind of objection that Mill and Popper raise. And Joanna says, right, not exactly. Yeah, I'm not clear what either of those is. Joanna says, I know that to be true that all men are mortal, but what I was referring to is how logic proves it. I see. Well, you see, I wasn't attempting to do that. It's a very good question you ask. I don't have a good answer. What I was just doing was saying what you would be doing in trying to prove it. You would be claiming either that you can directly grasp the truth of a proposition, or claiming there are certain metaphysical premises, certain premises that enable you to deduce it. And then you have to know how we know those premises. So I wasn't attempting to explain how we know the proposition is true, or even claiming that it was true. I was just trying to sketch out what it would mean to say that it was true, where we're not appealing to just going through all the mess. Now, Joe says, since immortality is rare, wouldn't it be easier to try to enumerate those who are immortal? Now, here you're raising a point also raised by Popper. It's very easy, say, if you have a universal proposition, say, all men are mortal, all you do is come up with one instance, and then you've made shown the proposition is false. Whereas with a universal proposition, all men are mortal, it seems like you can't establish it just by enumeration. So you're quite right. If you could show one, just come up with one in which it's false, then you've shown the whole proposition is false. That's a very good point you read. But what I was trying to argue is that we shouldn't think, and I think this is a mistake Popper made, to think, well, all we have is enumeration, so then we can't really establish, then the syllogism doesn't really work, because we couldn't know the conclusion is true unless we already put that in the major premise in the first place. So I was just trying to sketch a way in which that argument doesn't work. You see, you get into, say, if you take that argument, you know, remember, what is Mill saying? He says, well, all syllogism beg the question because you wouldn't know the conclusion is true unless you already included it in the major premise. So then you might apply that same argument to what he's saying and say, well, how does he know that that's true for all arguments unless he's gone through all arguments? In which case he's already included those in, he's gone through all possible arguments, so he obviously hasn't. So he seems to be appealing to just a sort of conceptual necessity he claims there's no such thing as conceptual necessity, but then if that was true, how could he say that this is true of all arguments? You see, Murray was right about John Stuart Mill. Just a joke there, I should say. I tend to think there is more to Mill than Murray did. Murray really didn't like him. I think Mill has some very interesting things to say about all sorts of things, but I think he was mistaken on this point. If I remember when I was in junior high, I read Mill's The Liberty, famous essay in 1859. I thought that had some very interesting arguments in it. But So we have still have a few minutes left. I'm surprised whoever it was who's calling hasn't called again. They've only interrupted my lecture twice. Maybe they won't be, they shouldn't be satisfied with that. Well, I see we have a few minutes left. I'll tell you while we're waiting for questions what I thought was the funniest remark I heard last week at the Austrian Scholars Conference. I saw Leland Jaeger there, who's a, I mean, you know, he's a very well-known economist. He's in his 80s now. So I said hello to him. I said to him, how are you feeling? And he said to me, let's not get into that right now. Well, I thought it was funny anyway. Oh, wait, here's a question here is, Joanna says, in the argument narrowing possibility, let's say free markets need rules. Rules are the outcome of government. Free markets need the overlook or intervention of government. Well, I mean, you could certainly argue, I mean, that if you argued in that way, you wouldn't be committing any formal fallacy. And then the question is, could it be, can it be that the comeback for one would be to try to bring the debate back to choices being argued? Yes, that would be right. I mean, somebody could say, well, do you mean someone, like someone could say, well, you're talking about the objection is, well, what about rules without a government? This person would say, well, we can't have rules without the government. Yes, that's right. Somebody could certainly argue that way. Then it would be up to him to show why he thinks that, but he wouldn't be committing a formal fallacy that way. What the fallacy was, at least in the way I was reading that paragraph, was that this author, Roderick, seems to be moving just from saying, well, we need rules to saying we need government. He hasn't specified that all rules come from government. But, I mean, I think you're quite right. If he wanted to make that as an explicit premise, then he wouldn't be committing any formal fallacy, but it would be more out in the open that that premise is controversial. If he just said, well, we need rules, and people say, oh, yeah, sure, we need rules, and then he kind of slips in that we need government. But if you make it explicit, then the argument wouldn't be committing a formal fallacy, then you might be more alert to want to challenge the premise. Okay, let's see, anybody else have anything here? Now, he says, I watched Jared Casey talk about his new book, apparently says you outgun him in jokes. Well, he has better jokes. You know, I was on the shuttle with him going to the conference about an hour and 45 minutes, so we were exchanging jokes. He's a very good friend of mine. He's very good. Now, it's funny, he teaches in Ireland, National University. He gives a course in scholastic logic also. We were exchanging various points on what to teach. He starts his course by saying, oh, you're all going to, most people should get out of this course. You're not going to do well. Take something else. And he says no one believes him. They think he's kidding, but he isn't. Now, Joe says, but is government the only enforcer? Well, I don't think it is, but I mean, that's a question, substantive question. Remember, in this course, we're just concerned with the structure of the argument. So I would say it isn't, but I mean, that wouldn't be a question that really isn't really going to occupy us in this course. Joanna said, Dr. Paul used that debate, got my attention. I think he's a very good at making good points in debate. She says, my ex is doing her doctorate in his department. Oh, and does she like him? He's a very good philosopher, I think, finally. Good joke. So Jared Casey looks very much like Heidegger. I always tease him about that, Heidegger's come back. Well, I guess we're out of time now, so next week will be Lecture 6. And remember, Lecture 7, which is not the one next week, but the one week after, I think we're doing it a different time. We're doing that. The one 2 weeks from now will be at a later time, but we'll remind you of that next week. So thanks very much. Thank you, everybody. Now I'm going to find out who it was who called me. Okay, thanks.